All right, so today we're diving into something you might not expect. The Ozark winter landscape.
Okay.
It's easy to think that everything's kind of asleep out there when it's cold,
Yeah.
but we're here to uncover all the hidden life that's actually thriving even when those trees are bare. I'm excited to learn all about the secrets of winter botany.
Yeah, me too.
And joining us to help decode these mysteries is an expert in Ozark plant life. I mean, it's not just identifying trees in the winter, but understanding, their stories, like their roles in the ecosystem, their history, even how they've adapted to survive these tough conditions.
Yeah, it's true. People often see winter as just a time when things are dormant. But for plants, it's more like a time of, clever strategies and hidden activity. It's really fascinating how they not just survive, but even thrive when it seems like everything's frozen solid.
All right, so picture this.
Okay.
A typical Ozark winter scene. Those rolling hills, the bare trees, maybe some frost on the ground. What are some of the most obvious signs of plant life we'd see right away?
Well, some plants don't even bother with dormancy.
Right.
The evergreens
Yeah.
keep their green all year round.
Yeah.
Here in the Ozarks, that means pines, cedars,
Yeah.
certain hollies, even the occasional magnolia. And then there's the yucca, which always throws people for a loop. Is it a shrub? Is it a tree? What is that
I
thing?
know.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you mean. The yucca definitely stands out. But tell me more about those pines and cedars. They seem to be like everywhere in the Ozarks, especially in the winter.
Yeah, you're right. The shortleaf pine is the dominant native pine around here.
Oh, okay.
And when it comes to cedars, there are actually two main types: Eastern red cedar and ash juniper, which some folks call rock cedar. They're both in the juniper family, hence those juniper berries. But here's where it gets interesting. Only the female Eastern red cedars have those berries. They're dioecious, which means there are separate male and female trees. So if you see a cedar without berries, it's a male.
So it's like a botanical mystery. You have to look closely to know which cedar is which. Now, how about those ash junipers?
Ah.
How can we tell them apart from the eastern red cedars, especially in winter?
Good question. Look for a few key differences. Ash junipers often have multiple trunks coming from the base,
Okay.
while eastern red cedars typically have a single main trunk. Plus, ash juniper bark often has whitish patches that you won't see on eastern red cedars.
So it's like a detective game,
Yeah.
using those subtle clues to figure out which cedar is which.
Exactly. And while we're on the topic of looking closely, let's not forget about the ferns. Believe it or not, we have several types of evergreen ferns in the Ozarks.
Evergreen ferns. Now that's a surprise.
Right. One that's super easy to spot is the Christmas fern. Its leaflets have this unique shape that reminds me of Santa's sleigh, a perfect little holiday symbol right in the forest.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
The Santa's sleigh fern, that's so easy to remember. Are there any other secrets that these ferns are hiding?
Well, here's something that makes ferns really special. Instead of reproducing with seeds like most plants, they use spores. That's a clue to their ancient lineage. They were around long before seed-bearing plants evolved.
Wow, so they're like living fossils.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder what these ancient forests look like, covered in
It
ferns.
really does. And speaking of ancient lineages, we can't forget about mosses.
Right.
They're technically evergreen too, although they're non-vascular plants.
Okay.
This means they don't have the same internal plumbing system that most plants use to transport water. Most mosses need to stay low to the ground because of this.
Oh, that makes sense. So they're like the minimalist, low maintenance plants of the forest.
Exactly. But then you have the pincushion moss, which is a total rebel. It defies those limitations and actually stands upright. And here's the kicker: even if you flip it upside down, it can adapt and keep growing.
That's incredible. It's a reminder that even the smallest plants have amazing adaptations to survive.
Absolutely. And that brings us to another plant that's not what it seems, the scouring rush.
Okay.
It might look like a rush, but it's actually a relic of the ancient horsetail family.
Yeah.
Those giant scale trees from prehistoric times. The scouring rush is a distant relative.
Wait, so those little plants I see growing along the creek are related to those towering giants? That's blowing my mind.
It's a reminder that the plant world is full of surprises, especially when you start digging into their history. And speaking of surprises, you might be shocked to learn that we even have cacti surviving the Ozark winters.
Cacti in the Ozarks, I always picture them baking in the desert sun. How do they handle the cold?
It's all about adaptation. The Eastern prickly pear is the main type we have here, and it's surprisingly tough. You might see them shriveled up during winter, but they're still alive, waiting for warmer days.
Okay, I'm officially intrigued.
Yeah.
So we've got these tough evergreens, ancient ferns, rebellious mosses, even cacti braving the cold.
Mm-hmm.
What else should we be looking for in this winter wonderland?
Well, let's talk about the grasses. You know, those might seem simple, but there's a lot going on there, too. For example, the poverty oak grass has these wonderfully curly blades, adding a touch of whimsy to the landscape.
It's like nature's calligraphy. Those delicate curves are so beautiful, especially against a backdrop of bare trees.
And there's a reason why some grasses stay green all winter while others disappear. It comes down to whether they're cool season or warm season grasses. Take the wild rye, for example.
Okay.
We have a few different types. Virginia wild rye, Canadian wild rye, and bottle brush grass. They're all cool season, meaning they stay green throughout the winter, but flower later in the year.
So the next time I see a patch of green grass in winter, I'll know it's a cool season grass patiently biding its time.
Exactly. And to tell the different wild ryes apart, you have to wait until spring and look at their seed heads. Each one has a unique shape, drooping, upright, or bottle brush-like.
So it's like a little botanical treasure hunt, waiting for spring to reveal the answer. Now, you mentioned those cacti are hiding out in certain habitats. Where should we look for them?
You'll often find them tucked away under eastern red cedars, which can actually be a bit of a problem.
Oh.
You see, cedars are known to invade glade habitats, which are the open, sunny areas where cacti thrive.
So the cedars are like the bullies of the plant world, pushing out the cacti.
It's a natural process, but it does highlight the importance of habitat conservation.
Yeah.
And managing those cedar populations.
Right.
Now, speaking of plants and unique habitats, let's shift our focus to the world of woody vines.
Okay, vines.
Yeah.
I always think of those as being so tangled up in the summer foliage. What are they up to in winter?
Some vines have persistent leaves, like the smilax, also known as greenbrier. And of course, there's mistletoe, which becomes much more visible when the trees have lost their leaves. But it's important to remember that not all mistletoe is created equal.
Oh, that's right. I've heard there are native and invasive species.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Well, native mistletoe plays a beneficial role in the ecosystem, providing food and shelter for birds and other animals. Invasive mistletoe, on the other hand, can harm trees and disrupt the natural balance.
So it's like a botanical good twin, evil twin situation. We'll have to learn how to tell them apart.
Right.
But before we get too tangled up in vines, you mentioned something about winter orchids. That sounds impossible.
It might sound surprising, but there are a few native orchids that actually keep their green leaves throughout the winter. Rattlesnake plantain, with its unique veined leaves, is one example. And then there's the putty root orchid, which keeps a single basal leaf all winter long.
Wow, winter orchids. I had no idea. That's a testament to the diversity of plant life, even in the coldest months. But what about all those deciduous trees that lose their leaves? How do we even begin to identify them without those obvious clues?
Ah, that's where the real detective work begins. We have to become botanical sleuths using clues like bark patterns, twig features, and even the fallen leaves themselves to unlock the secrets of these winter trees.
Bring on the challenge. I'm ready to sharpen my botanical detective skills.
Right.
What are some of the first clues we should look for?
Let's start with the bark. Some trees have incredibly distinctive bark patterns that make them easy to identify even without their leaves. For example, the black cherry has horizontal lines called lenticels that stand out even as the bark ages.
The black cherry, I remember seeing those lenticels. And speaking of memorable bark features, how about the honey locust and its massive thorns? I've definitely had a few close encounters with those.
Ouch.
Ouch. I think we've all learned to respect those thorns. And here's a fascinating theory. Those thorns might have evolved as a defense against megafauna like mastodons that roamed the Ozarks thousands of years ago.
Wait, thorns meant for creatures the size of elephants?
Yeah.
That puts things in perspective.
It makes you appreciate the long history of these trees and how they've adapted to survive all sorts of challenges. Now let's talk about another pair of trees that can be tricky to identify, the hackberry and the sugarberry. They both have those knobby bark patterns.
So what's the secret to telling them apart?
It's a combination of clues. Look at the leaf edges. Hackberry leaves have serrated edges, while sugarberry leaves are smooth.
Okay.
And think about their location. Hackberries tend to prefer upland areas, while sugarberries like moist soil and are often found in lower-lying areas.
It's like a botanical puzzle, using multiple pieces of information to get the full picture. This is fascinating. What other bark patterns should we be on the lookout for?
Let's move on to trees with blocky bark patterns.
Mm-hmm.
The persimmon is a great example. Its bark is broken up into these little blocks, which makes it pretty easy to spot.
Oh, the persimmon. I always associate that with its delicious fruit in the fall. It's amazing how those fruits develop from those tiny flowers earlier in the year. What other trees have that blocky bark?
The flowering dogwood is another one. Its bark has this alligator scale pattern, very distinctive and easy to remember. And like the persimmon, it offers a taste of spring with its beautiful white blooms later in the year.
Alligator scale bark. I love that description.
Yeah.
I can definitely picture that. Are there any other trees with this type of bark we should know about?
The rusty blackhaw. It's in the viburnum family and produces those edible fruits that foragers call wild raisins.
Wild raisins. Now that's something I've got to try. I'm adding that to my foraging list for sure.
Always make sure you've correctly identified any plant before you eat it, of course.
Mm.
Now, speaking of identification, there's a tree that's often misidentified in the Ozarks, the Ozark chinkapin. It's got a fascinating story and, unfortunately, a rather sad one.
Oh, I've heard about the Ozark chinkapin. What makes it so special, and why is its story so sad?
Well, for starters, it's a type of chestnut native to this region. Its bark pattern helps distinguish it from other trees, like the chinkapin oak. But the sad part is that it was once a dominant tree in the Ozarks, but a blight nearly wiped it out in the early 1900s.
That's heartbreaking. What happened?
A tiny fungus, really.
Oh, wow.
It spread through the Ozark chinkapin population, causing widespread death. Imagine a forest full of these beautiful nut-bearing trees, and then suddenly they're almost gone.
Yeah.
It had a major impact on the ecosystem, not to mention the people who relied on those nuts for food.
It's hard to imagine such a dramatic change. Are there any Ozark chinkapins left at all?
Thankfully, yes. There are a few scattered individuals, and some seem to have a natural resistance to the blight. There's even an Ozark chinkapin foundation working to restore the species. I actually had a friend identify two Ozark chinkapins on his property a few years back.
That's a glimmer of hope. It's amazing how such a small thing can have such a devastating impact, but also how nature can sometimes find a way to bounce back.
It's a reminder that we need to protect our native species and the delicate balance of the ecosystem. Now let's shift gears a bit and look at some other distinctive bark patterns. The American sycamore is a real standout with its exfoliating bark that reveals a white underbark.
Oh yeah, the sycamore. It's like it's shedding its skin to reveal a fresh new layer underneath. I always find those peeling bark patterns so fascinating.
And then we have the shagbark hickory, aptly named for its long peeling strips of bark. It's like it has a bad case of bedhead.
I love that. And the river birch is another one with a unique bark texture, right? That shredded, papery look is so delicate and beautiful.
Exactly. And finally, there's the American beech with its smooth gray bark. It's a classic sign of a mature forest.
So if I see a beech tree, it means the forest has been relatively undisturbed for a long time.
Yeah.
That's really cool. It's like the trees are telling us the history of the landscape.
They really are. And speaking of unique features, the winged elm has these curious woody growths along its stems, almost like wings.
Oh yeah, the winged elm. I've always wondered about those. Are there any other trees that have them?
You might see similar growths on young sweet gum trees, but they tend to lose them as they age. And speaking of sweet gums, those produce the familiar gumballs that we all love to hate.
I know those gumballs all too well. They're experts at sticking to my shoes. What other trees have those distinctive seed pods?
Well, the American sycamore has seed balls too, but they're much smoother than the sweet gum's spiky gumballs.
Okay.
And then there's the American hop hornbeam, which produces hop-like fruits that are quite unique.
Hop-like fruits. I'll have to keep an eye out for those. It seems like every tree has its own signature look, even in winter.
That's the beauty of it. And that brings us to the next level of our botanical detective work. Twig identification.
Okay, twigs.
Yeah.
I'll admit, this is where I start to feel a bit lost. They all look so similar to me. How do we even begin to tell them apart?
Don't worry, it's not as daunting as it seems. Once you learn a few key features, you'll be surprised at how much you can differentiate. First, look for leaf scars. The marks left behind when the leaves fall off.
Leaf scars, okay. What kind of clues do they give us?
They can tell us a lot about the tree's growth history. The shape and size of the leaf scar can help you narrow down the species.
Okay.
You can also see lateral buds, which will grow into new leaves come spring, and bud scale scars, which are marks left from previous year's growth.
So the twig is like a miniature timeline of a tree's life. That's pretty amazing.
Right. And speaking of timelines, we can also use leaf arrangement patterns to identify trees in the winter. The most common pattern is alternate, where the leaves come off the stem in an alternating pattern.
Alternate, okay. What are the other patterns?
Then there's opposites, where leaves grow in pairs directly across from each other on the stem. And the rarest pattern is whorled, where three or more leaves come out from the same point on the stem.
Whorled? That sounds interesting. So if we see opposite leaf scars on a twig, it narrows down our possibilities quite a bit, right?
Absolutely. It's one of those key clues that can save you a lot of time when trying to figure out what tree you're looking at. Now let's take a look at some examples of trees with alternate leaves.
Okay. I'm ready to put my new knowledge to the test.
The black walnut is a good one to start with. It has a very distinctive leaf scar that some people say looks like an alien face.
An alien face. I'll have to look for that. And I remember you mentioning that black walnut leaves are compound. What does that mean exactly?
Good point. A compound leaf is made up of multiple leaflets.
Okay.
Whereas a simple leaf is just a single leaf blade. One way to tell the difference is by looking for nodes.
Nodes? What are those?
Nodes are the points on the stem where leaves or branches go out. With a compound leaf, you'll see a node where the whole leaf structure attaches to the stem, but not at the base of each individual leaflet.
Okay.
With a simple leaf, there's just one node at the base of the single leaf blade.
Okay, I think I'm getting that. So if there's a node where the whole leaf attaches, but not at the base of each leaflet, it's compound. Got it. What other trees have alternate leaves?
The mockernut hickory is another common one with compound leaves. Now let's move on to trees with those opposite leaf arrangements. Remember the mnemonic madcap horse?
Ah, yes, madcap horse. That stands for
maple, ash, dogwood, caprifoliaceae, which is the honeysuckle family.
Right.
And buckeye, also called horse chestnut.
Okay, madcap horse. Got it. So if we see opposite leaf scars, we know it's one of those five possibilities. That's really helpful.
Right. It narrows things down considerably. Now let's zoom in on some of those madcap horse trees and see what makes them unique in winter.
Okay, I'm all ears. What should we look for?
Let's start with the maples. Silver maple has those opposite buds, and each maple species has its own distinctive bud shape. Red maple, for example, often has reddish buds, making it easier to spot in winter.
Reddish buds. Okay. I'll be on the lookout for those. What about the ash trees?
Green ash and white ash are two common ones around here. The key to telling them apart lies in the position of the bud within the leaf scar. The white ash bud is nestled deeper into the leaf scar, giving it a sort of smiley face shape.
A smiley face.
Yeah.
Okay. That's an image I won't forget.
And don't forget about habitat.
Right.
Green ash prefers moist soil, while white ash is more likely to be found in drier areas. So it's another clue to help with identification.
It's like piecing together a puzzle. You have to consider the bark, the twigs, even where the tree is growing to figure out what it is. I'm really enjoying this.
I'm glad you are. Now, what about the dogwoods? You've probably seen those distinctive buttons on the tips of their branches.
Oh, yes. Those little buttons are so cute.
Yeah.
What are they exactly?
Believe it or not, those are next year's flower buds. They start developing in winter, just waiting for spring to burst open.
Wow. So those buttons are like tiny packages of spring waiting to unfold.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much is happening beneath the surface, even when everything looks bare.
Exactly. Now, a word of caution when you're around American beech trees in the winter, watch out for those pointy buds.
Mm-hmm.
They can poke you in the eye if you're not careful.
Good advice. I'll definitely be keeping a safe distance from those pointy beech buds. So we've talked about bark, twigs, and leaf arrangement. Is there anything else we can use to identify trees in the winter?
You might be surprised to learn that even fallen leaves can be helpful. Sometimes they retain enough of their shape and structure to offer clues, especially when combined with the bark and twig features.
Fallen leaves? I never thought about that. I usually just see them as part of the brown, crunchy carpet on the forest floor.
And speaking of leaves, there's a fascinating phenomenon called leaf marcescence that we should talk about.
Leaf marcescence? That sounds interesting. What is it?
It's when trees hold on to their dead leaves all winter long. Beech, oaks, especially the white oak group, and sugar maples are common examples.
So they're like clinging onto autumn a little longer. I've definitely seen that. Why do they do that?
Well, there are a few theories. One is that those marcescent leaves might help protect the buds from cold damage, acting like a little blanket.
That makes sense. It's like the tree is giving its buds a little extra protection from the winter elements.
Right. And it creates a really unique visual effect in the winter landscape. Imagine a beech grove with all those light brown leaves still clinging to the branches. It's a striking contrast to the bare branches of other trees.
I can picture it now. It's beautiful. It's like the trees are holding on to a little piece of autumn magic.
And speaking of magical things to find in the winter landscape, let's move on to the world of winter fruits.
Winter fruits. Now that sounds like a real treat.
There's more out there than you might think. And they're not just pretty to look at. They also play a vital role in the ecosystem, providing food for wildlife during the lean winter months. Let's start with a fruit that always sparks curiosity, the Osage orange, also known as the hedge apple.
Oh, the hedge apple. I've seen those big, green, brain-like fruits lying around. What's the story behind those?
They're not exactly edible for humans, but they do provide a food source for wildlife, especially birds. And historically, they were used to create hedgerows, basically living fences.
Living fences? That's so cool. I can picture these dense rows of Osage orange trees creating a natural barrier.
Exactly. And speaking of barriers, let's circle back to the rusty blackhaw we discussed earlier. Remember those wild raisins it produces?
Yes. I'm definitely going to be looking for those.
Just be sure to distinguish them from the American beauty berry, which also produces clusters of berries. They're different genuses, but they can look similar at first glance.
So how can I tell them apart?
Look at the leaves and the berry clusters. Coral berry has smaller leaves and fewer larger berries in each cluster. The American beauty berry, on the other hand, has larger leaves and more abundant, smaller berries.
Okay, got it. Smaller leaves, fewer berries for the coral berry, larger leaves, more berries for the beauty berry. Anything else that sets them apart?
The coral berry is also a host plant for certain butterflies and moths, so it plays an important role in the food web. It's a reminder that even these small plants are connected to a larger ecosystem.
It's amazing how everything is connected. Now, what about those classic winter berries? Are those hollies?
You're thinking of the deciduous holly, also known as winterberry. It's different from the American holly, which is evergreen.
Right.
The winterberry loses its leaves in the fall, but those bright red berries hang on throughout the winter, adding a splash of color to the landscape.
I love winterberry. It's such a cheerful sight.
And the flowering dogwood also have red fruits in winter, but technically they're not berries. They're called drupes.
Drupes. Okay. I'll have to remember that. So we've got red berries on the winterberry, red drupes on the flowering dogwood, and wild raisins on the rusty blackhaw. What other winter fruits should we be looking for?
Don't forget about the nuts.
Right?
Oaks produce acorns, and you can actually use the size and shape of the acorn cap to help you identify the oak species.
Oh.
For example, bur oak acorns are large with a distinctive fringed cap, while white oak acorns are longer with a cap that covers less of the nut. And then there's the overcup oak, which has smaller acorns, with a cap that covers most of the nut.
So it's like a botanical puzzle using the acorns to figure out which oak is which.
Exactly. Now let's talk about the difference between white oaks and red oaks.
White oaks and red oaks, is there an easy way to tell them apart in winter?
You can often tell by the leaf lobes, even if the leaves have fallen. White oaks typically have rounded lobes, while red oaks have pointed lobes with bristles at the tips.
So rounded lobes for white oaks, pointed lobes with bristles for red oaks. Seems simple enough.
It usually is, but there are always exceptions in the plant world. The blackjack oak, for example, has rounded lobes, but also has bristles at the tips. It's a reminder that you have to consider all the clues, not just one single feature.
Good point. It's all about being a careful observer and thinking like a detective.
Exactly. Now let's move on to hickory nuts. Bitternut, mockernut, and shagbark hickory are all common in the Ozarks. As you might guess, the bitternut hickory produces nuts that are quite bitter.
So I should probably avoid those. What about the other hickory nuts? Are they edible?
The mockernut and shagbark hickory nuts are both edible and have a delicious buttery flavor. They're a real treat if you can find them.
I'll be on the lookout. Speaking of nuts, I always see those black walnut husks staining the roads in the fall. Is there a reason for that?
Those husks contain an oil that can stain pavement. So be careful where you park your car under a black walnut tree.
Good tip. I'll try to remember that. What other winter fruits might we encounter?
Well, we already talked about the sweet gums gumballs and the American sycamore smooth seed balls. And the American hop hornbeam produces those hop-like fruits we mentioned earlier. And finally, let's circle back to the Ozark chinkapin. Remember those small single nuts encased in burrs?
Yeah.
Those are its fruits, but be careful if you try to collect them. Those burrs are prickly.
Good advice. I'll make sure to wear gloves. Wow, we've covered a lot of ground. I'm amazed at the diversity of winter fruits in the Ozarks.
It is impressive, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we're not done yet.
Oh.
There's one more surprise I have in store for you.
Another surprise? You've got me on the edge of my seat. What is it?
Believe it or not, There are even plants that bloom in the winter.
Winter blooms? That sounds impossible. Why would a plant bloom when there are fewer insects around to pollinate them?
That's a great question, and it leads us to the fascinating world of winter-blooming plants and their unique adaptations. Let's start with the witch hazels. We have two types here in the Ozarks, common witch hazel and Ozark witch hazel.
Witch hazels, I love the name. What makes them so special?
Well, the common witch hazel has yellow flowers and blooms from September to December, while the Ozark witch hazel has red flowers and blooms from January to March.
So we have one that blooms in the early winter and one that blooms in the late winter. That's incredible.
They both prefer moist areas, so keep an eye out for them along streams or in other damp locations. But you're right, it does seem counterintuitive for them to bloom when there are fewer insects around.
Exactly. How do they manage to get pollinated?
They have a secret weapon. Owlet moths.
Owlet moths. I've never even heard of those.
These nocturnal moths are active in the winter and have this amazing ability to heat themselves up. This allows them to fly around on cold Ozark nights and pollinate the witch hazel flowers. It's a pretty amazing adaptation.
That is incredible. So it's like a perfectly synchronized partnership between the plant and the moth, even in the depths of winter.
It's a beautiful example of coevolution, where two species evolve together over time.
Right.
But the witch hazels aren't the only ones defying the odds and blooming in the winter. Believe it or not, the red maple also blooms in late winter, usually from February to March.
Red maple. I never knew that. So if I see red flowers on a tree with opposite leaf scars, it's got to be a red maple.
I got it. And that brings us to the herbaceous plants, the ones that typically die back to the ground in winter.
Right. The wild flowers and grasses. Most of those disappear completely in winter, don't they?
A lot of them do, but there are still clues we can use to identify them. It all comes down to persistent vegetation.
Persistent vegetation? What's that?
It's a fancy way of saying dead plant parts that remain standing throughout the winter. For example, the purple coneflower, a common wildflower in the Ozarks, often has dried seed heads that persist throughout the winter. They look kind of like little brown spiky balls on top of the stems.
Oh, I've seen those. I never really thought about what they were.
And those persistent seed heads aren't just there for looks. They provide food and shelter for wildlife during the winter months. Warm season grasses also leave behind persistent seed heads, so even though the plant itself is dormant, its remains are still contributing to the ecosystem.
So even in death, they're giving back to the natural world. It's amazing how every part of the cycle has a purpose.
Exactly. And those persistent structures can also help us identify the plant. For instance, the seed box, a type of Ludwigia, has unique box-shaped seed pods that are easy to spot in the winter.
I love how there are so many subtle clues to look for, even in the middle of winter. It's making me see the landscape with fresh eyes.
Exactly. And those persistent structures can also help us identify the plant. For instance, the seed box, a type of Ludwigia, has unique box-shaped seed pods that are easy to spot in the winter.
I love how there are so many subtle clues to look for, even in the middle of winter. It's making me see the landscape with fresh eyes.
That's what it's all about. Now, another plant with a memorable name is the wood oats. It has dangling seed heads that look just like fish on a line.
Fish on a line. That's perfect. I'm definitely going to be looking for those on my next hike. And of course, we can't forget about those cattails with their iconic seed heads, a classic sign of a wetland area.
Absolutely. And speaking of wetlands, you might see another grass called panic grass, also known as deer tongue grass, in those habitats. Its seed heads are pretty unique once you get to know them. But enough about seed pods. Let's talk about something truly magical.
Magical. Okay, you've got my attention. What is it?
Frost flowers? Have you ever seen them?
Frost flowers. I think I've heard of them, but I'm not sure I've ever actually seen one. What are they exactly?
They're not actual flowers, but delicate ice sculptures that form at the base of certain plants. It's a phenomenon caused by ice crystals pushing through the plant stems.
Ice crystals pushing through stems? That sounds incredible. How does that work?
It's a bit of a science lesson, but I'll try to keep it simple. Certain plants, like white crown beard, yellow crown beard, and dittany, have what we call pithy stems. This means their stems have a spongy central core that allows water to flow up from the roots. When the temperature drops below freezing, the water inside the stem freezes and expands. It creates pressure that forces ice crystals out through tiny cracks in the stem, and as more water freezes, it builds these intricate ribbon-like formations that resemble flowers.
Wow, so the plant is literally blooming with ice. It sounds like something out of a fairy tale. Where can I find these frost flowers?
They're most common in moist areas like meadows and fields, and they typically form on mornings after a hard freeze. Keep an eye out for those white crown-beard beurrier, yellow crown-beard and dittany plants, and you might just spot these ephemeral beauties.
Okay, frost flower hunting is officially on my winter bucket list.
Excellent. And remember, white crown-beard is also known as frost weed, so that's a good one to look for. The yellow crown-beard has winged stems, and dittany leaves smell like oregano.
So many details to remember. It's amazing how even the tiniest plants have these unique characteristics. This conversation has truly changed the way I see the winter landscape.
I'm glad to hear that. It's my goal to help people appreciate the beauty and complexity of the natural world, no matter the season.
We've definitely achieved that. I feel like I have a whole new set of eyes for exploring the Ozarks this winter.
And that brings me to an important point. Observation is key. Slow down, take a closer look, and you'll be amazed at what you discover. Even in winter, when things seem quiet, there's a whole world of fascinating details waiting to be noticed.
You're right. It's so easy to rush through life and miss those little wonders. What are some tips for training our eyes to see those subtle clues in the winter landscape?
Start with the most common and obvious species in your area. Once you get familiar with their winter characteristics, you can start branching out to less common species. And don't be afraid to make mistakes. Botanical identification is a lifelong learning process, and even the experts get stumped sometimes.
That's reassuring to hear. It's not about being perfect, it's about the journey of discovery. And I love the idea of starting with the common species, building a foundation of knowledge one tree at a time.
Exactly. And as you build that foundation, you'll start to notice patterns and connections that you might have missed before. You'll see how the bark patterns relate to the twig. Features how the leaf arrangement affects the overall shape of the tree, how the winter fruits provide sustenance for wildlife. It's all connected.
It's like a whole new world is opening up. I'm so excited to get out there and start exploring with my newfound winter botany knowledge.
That's the spirit. And there are so many resources available to help you on your journey. There's some great field guides specifically focused on winter identification. A few of my favorites are Autumn Leaves and Winter Berries in Arkansas and Woody Plants of the Southeastern United States, a winter guide. And if you can find a used copy, Winter Twigs of Arkansas is excellent, although it's out of print.
Okay, I'll definitely check those out. What about online resources?
The Arkansas Native Plant Society website is a fantastic resource. They have tons of information on native plants, including tips for identification. And of course, there are many helpful videos and articles available online.
So there's really no excuse for not learning. It's all at our fingertips.
Exactly. And as you explore and learn, you might even stumble upon something truly special, a rare species, a unique adaptation, or even a new frost flower formation. The possibilities are endless.
That's a beautiful thought. It's like a never-ending adventure right in our own backyard.
It really is. Winter botany is not just about identifying plants. It's about deepening our connection to the natural world and appreciating the beauty and resilience of life, even in the coldest months of the year.
That's so true. It's about seeing the world with fresh eyes, noticing the details, and marveling at the interconnectedness of it all.
Exactly. Now, as we wrap up our deep dive into winter botany, What are some key takeaways you hope our listeners will remember?
That's a great question. I think the biggest takeaway for me is that winter is not a time of emptiness or dormancy. It's a time of hidden beauty, adaptation, and resilience.
I love that. And to add to that, I'd say, don't underestimate the power of observation. Slow down, take a closer look, and you'll be amazed at what you discover.
You're right. It's about paying attention to those subtle clues, those bark patterns, persistent seed heads, even the frost flowers. They all tell a story about the plants and their relationship to the environment.
It's like nature is whispering secrets to us, and we just need to be quiet and listen.
That's beautifully put. And for our listeners who are eager to start their own winter botany explorations, what are some final words of advice you'd offer?
Don't be intimidated. Start with what you know. Observe carefully and don't be afraid to make mistakes. And most importantly, have fun. There's a whole world of wonder out there waiting to be discovered.
I couldn't agree more. This conversation has been so inspiring and I'm feeling eager to bundle up, grab my field guide and head out for a winter adventure.
That's the spirit. And remember, as you explore those Ozark hills and hollows this winter, what will you discover when you start looking closer?
That's a wonderful question to leave our listeners pondering. I'm sure they'll find all sorts of amazing things once they start paying attention. And that's a wrap on our deep dive into winter botany.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it really is. I'm already picturing myself out on a trail, eyes scanning the trees, trying to decipher those bark patterns and twig features. You've really given me a whole new way to see the winter landscape.
I think that's one of the most rewarding aspects of winter botany. It challenges you to look beyond the surface, to see the beauty and complexity that's often hidden from view.
It's like you said earlier, it's about shifting our perspective. Instead of seeing those bare trees as a sign of emptiness, we can now appreciate them as living sculptures, each with its own unique story to tell.
Exactly. And it's not just about the trees. Think about all those fallen leaves, those decaying logs. They might seem lifeless, but they're actually playing a vital role in the ecosystem. They're providing nutrients for the soil, shelter for insects, and even inspiration for those of us who take the time to notice them.
You know, I've always loved those crunchy leaves under my feet on a winter hike, but I never thought about their role in the bigger picture. It's like they're completing their life cycle, giving back to the forest that nurtured them.
It's a beautiful cycle, isn't it? And it reminds us that even in death, there's a sense of renewal and purpose.
It's making me think about those bare trees in a whole new light. I used to see them as a symbol of waiting, of anticipation for spring to return. But now I realize they're just as full of life as they are in the spring, just in a different way. It's like they're taking a deep breath, conserving their energy, and preparing for that burst of growth that will come with warmer days.
That's a wonderful way to put it. It's a time of introspection, of inner strength, of preparing for the next chapter. And it's a reminder that even in the stillness of winter, there's a constant hum of activity, a quiet anticipation of what's to come.
I can't wait to share this new perspective with my friends and family. Maybe we can even have a winter botany challenge. See who can identify the most trees by their bark.
That's a great idea. And who knows, maybe you'll inspire someone else to fall in love with the subtle wonders of the winter landscape.
That would be amazing. I think that's one of the most powerful things about knowledge. It spreads and sparks curiosity in others. Speaking of sparking curiosity, do you think there are any common misconceptions about plants in winter that we should address?
Oh, definitely. One of the biggest misconceptions is that plants are completely dormant in winter.
Right.
While it's true that above ground growth slows down or stops for many species, there's still a lot happening beneath the surface.
So even though we don't see it, those roots are still working hard.
Absolutely. They're still growing, storing energy, and preparing for the next growing season. It's a time of preparation and renewal, even if it's hidden from our view.
That's a good reminder that there's always more going on than meets the eye. It's like the plants are taking a deep breath, gathering their strength, and getting ready for the big burst of life that will come with spring.
That's a beautiful analogy. And it underscores the importance of patience and understanding, knowing that even when things seem quiet on the surface, there's a lot happening behind the scenes.
This whole conversation has been such an eye-opening experience. I feel like I've gained a whole new appreciation for the beauty and complexity of the Ozark winter landscape.
It's been a pleasure sharing my passion for winter botany with you.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden wonders of the winter world. We hope you've learned something new and maybe even sparked a newfound curiosity for exploring the natural world no matter the season.
Remember, the possibilities are endless. Get out there, explore, and see what you discover.